Lee Morgan, introducing the Taylor Report. This is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. That was Sidewinder. And today on the program, we're going to talk about two matters which should be getting the appropriate attention. There's a funny expression called the international community, and it never seems to be a function. And there's two places, Haiti, halfway point, about 5:30, we're going to be talking to Jean Saint-Ville, who was one of the organizers of a demonstration today in Ottawa on Parliament Hill, calling on the Canadian government to behave in a different way towards the Haitian people and to adopt an entirely new, sensible policy, something we have talked about on this show. And coming up soon, we'll be talking to Zafar Bengash of Crescent International, because there is a crisis in Kashmir, Indian-occupied Kashmir, which the world doesn't seem to notice, doesn't seem to want to take it to. I see very few headlines. I see no opinion pieces. And it's worrying, I'd say that. There's demonstrations, and there is a lot of violence. And it is an issue which involves Canada, because Canada was one of the countries that helped, said it was helping, arrange the new political configuration of what had been British India. To put a point on it, British-occupied India. Phil Conlon is here. How are you doing, Phil?
Good afternoon, Phil.
You're familiar with these subjects. You probably lived with them. You remember them evolving.
Actually, you know, the Kashmir thing has been a staple of our almost entire lifetimes. I mean, as a child, yes. I knew that there was going to be a referendum in Kashmir, and they were going to decide whether Pakistan or India is going to have it. So we're still waiting for the referendum.
Yes, and you're very patient, we thank you for that. And the millions of people who live there are probably, and they are asking exactly what you have. And it's politically strange. But you know, that's the kind of environment we're in. I think we might have Zafar Bengash with us. Are you there, Zafar?
Hello, Phil. Yes, I am.
Well, thanks very much. It's Zafar Bengash, Crescent International. You find him online, Crescent. But Zafar, tell me if I got it right. Crescent.ICIT.digital.org.
Well, that's great. That's the digital thing. But if people want to get straight to our website for Crescent Magazine, that's crescent-online.net.
Very good. Well, we've had a visitor in the city, a very distinguished one, and you were one of the organizers of the event, for him. It was President Masoud Khan of the Azad Kashmir. And his presence here comes at a time which is very should be one of international concern, because in Kashmir, that portion of Kashmir that is under the authority and occupied by Indian troops and an Indian governor, there's been years of unrest, and he spoke to that. And well, I guess I should to start off. There is a all these years, there's been really no international attention in a formal way that I'm aware of. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but recently the United Nations Human Rights Commission actually wrote a report concerning that portion of Kashmir under Indian control. And tell us about that.
Yes, we had a visit from the president of Azad Jammu and Kashmir, as you pointed out, President Masoud Khan, who is the president of Azad Kashmir. Azad means free. And so this is the part of Kashmir that is on the side of Pakistan, whereas there is the other portion, two-thirds of Kashmir, that is under Indian military occupation. And there has been a people's movement or uprising that actually dates back way back to actually 1931, not just 1947 when India and Pakistan came into existence. It goes back to 1931 because the ruler was very oppressive and the people staged an uprising against him. That uprising, of course, was ruthlessly put down by the ruler at that time. But since 1947, India has occupied that part of Kashmir through a military invasion. And when the people of Kashmir rose against Indian military occupation and, of course, their kith and kin from the Pakistani side, and when it became apparent to the Indian rulers that they were likely to lose the entire territory, they were the ones that went to the United Nations Security Council asking for intervention and a ceasefire. Mm-hmm. And this was then included in a resolution on January the 5th, 1949. And that was the first resolution. Then there were a series of resolutions, the gist of which was, number one, that there should be a ceasefire wherever the various troops are. Number two, that there should be demilitarization of the region. And number three, that a referendum should be held over there. Now, of course, the ceasefire came into place, but unfortunately, India refused to withdraw its troops. Although it's important to keep in mind that, number one, it was India that took the matter to the Security Council, and number two, that both India and Pakistan had agreed to the Security Council resolution because it was negotiated between them as well as the other members of the Security Council. And, of course, if troops are not withdrawn, then naturally a referendum cannot be held, because if you have foreign military occupation troops, people would be intimidated, as we see now, and this oppression has gone on. There have been periodic intensification in the people's uprising. Sometimes it subsides. The latest round began on July the 8th of 2016, and that was what basically was the anniversary that we wanted to commemorate. And the anniversary was that of a young Kashmiri freedom fighter, only 22 years old, but he was media savvy. He used the internet very effectively. He was very popular on the social media network, and he had tens of thousands of followers in Kashmir. And naturally, the Indian occupation troops saw him as a threat to their occupation, so they killed him in a fake encounter. They could have easily captured him alive, but they didn't want to capture him alive. And in fact, when he was killed on the night of July the 8th, 2016, the Indian media, television, and others chortled about this, that we have eliminated the main person who was creating trouble for us, and they considered that to be a great victory for Indian military occupation forces. Mm-hmm. The very next day, although the military occupation forces imposed a curfew in Kashmir, but more than 200,000 people participated in the funeral procession of that young man. His name was Burhan Wani. And, of course, so this latest round of protests, as well as Indian oppression, military oppression, has been going on since July the 8th of 2016. Mm-hmm. And it was to this aspect that President Masood Khan and other people spoke in Toronto and various places. There was there were gatherings at various locations. Then there were two conferences, one in Mississauga, at which you also very kindly spoke, as well as Ken Stone from the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War. Then on Sunday, there was a conference in Hamilton, mm-hmm. At which President Khan, myself, Ken Stone, and a number of other people spoke. And again, this was related to the killing of Burhan Wani 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was impressed with the fact, and this I would really hope to Canadians ought to think about this, that this, as you pointed out, India is the party that asked the United Nations to come and arrange a reasonable and peaceful settlement of the matter.
Yes.
And they did not dispute the call for the recommendation of troop reduction and withdrawal and a plebiscite.
That is correct.
am I right that they I guess we have to be, if I were to put a cynical interpretation, at least say they did give some lip service to it. They said, yes, we agree.
That is correct, yes. In fact, even prior to this resolution being approved by the Security Council, as far back as October of 1947, when the Indian troops first went into Kashmir, then Indian Prime Minister Nehru actually sent a telegram to his Pakistani counterpart promising that this is only a temporary measure and that as soon as law and order, as he put it, law and order has been restored. And law and order, of course, at that time was because the people of Jammu and Kashmir, who were overwhelmingly Muslims and they wanted to become part of Pakistan, because historically, culturally, traditionally, Kashmir is linked with Pakistan. And so in order to deflect strong criticism, Nehru pledged in that telegram to his Pakistani counterpart that as soon as law and order has been restored and a proper mechanism has been put in place, a referendum or a plebiscite would be held in Kashmir to ascertain the wishes of the people. There was also another important statement issued by the British viceroy, Lord Mountbatten, who continued to remain from the colonial period. He continued to be the viceroy of India. Pakistan, of course, refused to accept him because they felt that he had been dishonest. And so they did not accept him as their viceroy or the governor general, as he was called at that time. And Mountbatten also announced that a referendum would be held because the people of Kashmir must decide what they want to do, whether they want to join Pakistan or they want to be part of India. Mm-hmm. And this pledge by Nehru was repeated again as far back as 1951, 52. And there were a number of Security Council resolutions to this effect. But what happened throughout was that while India publicly stated, yes, we accept this, we will abide by it, in practical terms, they refused to do anything. So, for instance, the Security Council resolution called for a reduction of troops. India said, yes, okay, we will do, but they just simply didn't do it. They just kept on dragging their feet. This proposal regarding the reduction of troops, incidentally, was drawn up by a Canadian, General A.G. McNaughton, a well-known person, a very famous military officer.
He has a very distinguished name, both as a military officer, but as a political representative at the United Nations,
exactly.
The ambassador. And I think he was the president,
of the Security Council, was he not? Exactly. He was the president of the Security Council at the time when this resolution was passed. And in fact, Canada played a leading role through General McNaughton in drawing up that Security Council resolution. And of course, you know, it was unanimously passed. There were only two abstentions out of a total of 15 members of the Security Council. 13 members, in other words, voted for the resolution. There were two abstentions of two members that were on the Security Council at the time. And Canada played a major role in not only drafting the proposals, but getting the two sides, both India and Pakistan, to agree to the terms. And then after that, General McNaughton actually was appointed as a special representative for Kashmir. And he went there, he looked at the environment and the situation, he drew up the proposals. Then, of course, once he had submitted his proposals to the Security Council, again, this was called the United Nations Commission for India and Pakistan, which he headed initially. Then after him, there was an Australian jurist, Sir Owen Dixon, who was appointed. He similarly went to Kashmir, interacted with various political figures in Kashmir, both on the Indian side as well as Pakistani side, and also with representatives of the two governments of India and Pakistan. And again, he drew up a list of recommendations to the Security Council. And although publicly India would say, yes, we see the merit in this and we will do this or we will do that, but practically They did everything to obstruct the preparation of the ground to hold a referendum. And of course, gradually, as India tightened its military grip on Kashmir, it started to backtrack even from accepting that proposal. Mm-hmm. So now we see 71 years later that Indian military forces are still there in very large numbers. In fact, India maintains 700,000 army troops. That is, half of the entire Indian army is deployed in Kashmir.
And basically Kashmir, in Pakistan.
Absolutely, exactly, yes. Which is, in fact, 700,000 troops is more than the total armed forces strength of Pakistan.
Certainly more than the Canadian forces.
Oh, far higher than that. Yes, of course, of course. At the same time, those troops have perpetrated horrible crimes there. They have not only taken tens of thousands of people, just arbitrarily taken young men, dragged them from their homes. These people mm-hmm. have simply disappeared. Mm-hmm. There have been thousands of mass graves that have been discovered in Kashmir.
Well, this comes up in the report, does it not?
I mean, there exactly.
is. I mean, for all these years, as you, I know that you've spoken to this and others, but now we have a UN report which seems to confirm these things that you're telling us.
Exactly. We've been talking about this for years. And finally, I'm glad that the United Nations High Commission for Human Rights finally put that in a report through their investigation, although, again, when the United Nations High Commissioner's office contacted Pakistan and India for permission to visit their side of Kashmir, Pakistan said, "You are more than welcome." India again refused. And so what the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights had to do was to do it through remote monitoring, as they put it. And mm-hmm. that meant that they had to contact people inside Indian-occupied Kashmir, human rights organizations and others, and through email messages, etc., to get information from them, reports from them as to what was taking yeah. place.
I want to raise something that I see. I'm reading the Indian commentary and others talking about the matter of the, you know, the troops, the troop presence, and the laws under which they function. And my understanding is from that the report confirms, perhaps you can correct me on this, please, that they have actually given the troops impunity, that is, the officers can decide on the scene what they're going to do, and
yes.
they won't be subject to, let's say, political authority. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely.
The word, I guess, is impunity.
That is correct. There are two laws or two statutes or acts that have been put in place. One, the Armed Forces Services Protection Act, and the second is the Prevention of Terrorism Act or something like that. And under both these draconian laws, Indian troops are given carte blanche to do whatever they want over there. So they kill people, they shoot people completely without provocation.
Yeah. And by the way, I should say, there's a cover for this. I noticed that they say, well, they investigate, but there has been no one prosecuted, has there?
No, none whatsoever. Nobody.
Not one.
Nobody has been prosecuted. No investigations have taken place. Nothing whatsoever. In fact, these troops are involved in other hideous crimes, for instance, raping women. There have been, since 1989, these are documented cases of more than 11,075 women or girls that have been raped. And in fact, these are again documented through investigation by hospital sources in Kashmir and from police, local police forces. The youngest person that was raped was a 7-year-old child, and the oldest woman that was raped was a 70-year-old grandmother. Mm-hmm. And only recently there was a horrible case of an 8-year-old girl, Asifa her name was. She was kidnapped at the end of January of this year under a pre-planned operation by 8 men. and they kidnapped her and took her to a Hindu temple. This was in Jammu. And they gang raped her, these eight men, they gang raped this poor child for 3 days. And they had pre-planned all of this, and then naturally they were not going to let her go alive, and they had already planned that they were going to kill her. So they took her out of the temple, and they tried to strangle her, and as they were strangling her, one of the assailants also picked up a rock and smashed her head twice so that, you know, in order to make sure that she was dead. And when the body was discovered several weeks later, of course, the police were investigating. Her poor parents were walking all over the place looking for their daughter. They never thought that, you know, her daughter would be inside a temple. They thought a temple would be a place of worship and sanctuary. And yet these horrible men, these eight men, took that poor girl into a temple, and this is what they did to her. Mm-hmm. And when her body was discovered, there were very brutal bruise marks on her body. Her eyes had been swollen, you know, all kinds of terrible things had been done to her.
You say the documentation for that is provided by what kind of source is that?
That is provided by the police forces in Jammu itself. Like the police force, despite all of the terrible things that happened and all of the pressure on them, they still investigated.
They made that report.
They made that report, exactly. And
now, by the way, when they do that, I mean, they have a problem, don't they? They would be local. They would be Kashmiris as opposed to Indian.
That
so
is correct.
They have the problem of actually dealing, confronting, or asking the Indian Army to turn over the perpetrators or
that
to identify
them.
And that leads me to a question, because I noticed today that there was that in June of this year, the government of India changed the their method of governance, I guess you'd put it that way. They've named a governor and they've removed the local political leader. Is that right?
That is correct. Basically, what it was, when elections were held in Jammu and Kashmir, these are local elections under which...
Not plebiscites.
They're not plebiscites. No, these are local elections. And even the parties that, the Kashmiri parties that do participate in these elections, they emphasize and they make completely clear that these elections are purely for local administrative purposes. They always emphasize that and say that they have nothing whatsoever to do with a referendum or a plebiscite or determining the wishes of the people as to whether they are giving their consent to be ruled by India. So when the last elections were held, there was a Kashmiri party that had cynically aligned itself with the ruling BJP, the Bharatiya Janata Party, which is, of course, the ruling party
in
Delhi. And they entered into a coalition. And so next year, which is 2019, there are again going to be general elections in India. And in India today, under the BJP, there is this rise of Hindu fundamentalism. It's a vicious ideology that is patterned on the Nazis. They, in fact, their literature extol Nazi propaganda. They proudly quote passages from Hitler's notorious Mein Kampf, and they make no bones about the fact that they admire the manner in which Hitler conducted his genocidal policies. And so these Hindu fundamentalists are pursuing a similar policy in India, whereby religious minorities, whether they are Muslims, Christians, Sikhs, Buddhists, others that are being targeted, and in fact, there are public lynchings of Muslims taking place in India these days, which regrettably we don't hear about much in the news or media.
Apropos of that, I mean, that's so they decided they didn't want this alliance any longer than with the local Kashmiri.
Exactly. It was the BJP that pulled out of the alliance because for them to run an effective campaign next year, they have to present themselves as being anti-Muslim. And so they felt that if they were to be still in the alliance with this Kashmiri party in Kashmir, then the opposition would point out to their hypocrisy and say, well, in Kashmir, you are in alliance with a Muslim political party, and here you claim that Muslims are a threat to India.
So it would be damaging to them in their political base to be in alliance with this group. So the government resorted simply, you know, it sounds like an echo of the British system. They simply have a governor.
Yes.
And the governor decides.
When a political party does not have enough power in parliament, then they impose what is referred to as governor rule. So essentially, now Indian occupied Kashmir does not have a local administration. Delhi, the capital of India, they have appointed a governor. And the governor is answerable directly mm-hmm. to the government in India. So in other words, the situation has gone even worse. I also want to point out that over the years, in fact, over several decades, and all of these terrible things happening in Kashmir, initially, back in 1989, 1990, we would read some coverage of the events taking place in Kashmir, the horrible things happening over there. But regrettably now, for the last 27, 28 years, there has been a deafening silence. Television stations, newspapers, radio stations, etc., apart from yours, I must say, to your great credit. Yeah,
thank you. I hear that very often on this show.
Yeah, that you know,
there are places where reporting doesn't seem to work.
Exactly. That, you know, they've just maintained a total silence. They refuse to address this issue. I guess the problem is that often people suffering or human rights issues or issues of this nature are influenced by political preferences.
There's a terrible expression, real politic.
That's correct, yes. And that's what's at play over here as well, because Canada and other Western countries are trying to cultivate good relations with India because they see it as an emerging market.
Yeah. But they also have their fingers crossed behind their back, don't they? Because have they ever changed their position on how the matter should proceed with Kashmir? Have they ever repudiated the call for a plebiscite?
Well, now what India says is that Kashmir is its integral part. And the argument that they use is that, well, we have held so many elections and the people have had their say. And so if they hold elections, that means that they accept India's hegemony. Although within the Indian constitution, there is an article 370, that confers special status on Kashmir, which means that Kashmir is not like any other state in India. I mean, India has many states, like, you know, we call them provinces here, but basically mm-hmm. that's what it is. All the other states operate within the Indian constitution. And mm-hmm. Kashmir is referred to as a special case under Article 370. Mm-hmm. And yet Indian rulers very stubbornly and quite idiotically continue to maintain the fiction that, well, now that we have had so many elections in Kashmir, therefore a referendum or a plebiscite is no longer.
No, that would be the position of the Indian government. I just wonder, has Canada or the United States, Britain, France, Russia or others, have they said, we're going to set aside our definition of this entity and accept that that it is Indian officially Indian territory?
No country in the world has accepted that at all.
That's what I thought. By the way, let's remind everybody that Arundhati Roy, a very distinguished writer and journalist, risked her life, actually. She visited the region, and then she gave talks about it, and she's been writing about it. They've talked about arresting her. But her point, she uses the expression, seems to me useful. She says it's unfinished business. In other words, it is still there.
Yes.
On the agenda.
Absolutely. And you mentioned Arundhati Roy. She's a very, very courageous person. She has faced death threats. The Indian police and Indian, particularly the BJP, they have even threatened her with rape. This is on record. This is nothing that's hidden. And yet she continues to speak out, and she says that it's not only unfinished business because the issue of the referendum has to be held, but the reference to unfinished business is, of course, the business of the completion of the partition plan of 1947, under which India and Pakistan emerged.
This is actually was a sticking point, and I guess it would behoove us and for have you to explain to our listeners, this is Zafar Bengash, why did it happen that Pakistan came into being, India came into being? It was basically a break between the division, Hindu, you might say Hindu confessional, and the Islamic. How did it happen that Kashmir didn't get solved at the time?
Well, basically, what the British had done was very, of course, devious manner, that wherever there was a Muslim majority in any particular state, they would impose a Hindu ruler. Mm-hmm. And wherever the Muslims were in a majority, they would have the Hindus were in a majority, they would have a Muslim ruler. So I can give you a parallel example with this, that there was a Muslim ruler in Hyderabad, Dakkan, as it's called, very prosperous place, but the majority of the people were Hindus. And the Muslim ruler was a patron of the arts, of education. He established excellent universities over there for all people, not just for Muslims, for everybody. And when India and Pakistan gained independence, he expressed the desire that he wished to join Pakistan. And so what Nehru did was he simply ordered his army into Hyderabad, and he said, no, you can't join Pakistan because the majority of the people here are Hindus. And he then turned this logic on its head when he went into Kashmir, where the ruler was Hindu, and the majority in the valley, Kashmir Valley, the majority is 97% Muslim. In Jammu, the other province or the other state attached to it, the Muslim majority was 62%. But because, unfortunately, due to ethnic cleansing, etc., over the years, it has now been reduced to a minority. Yet, over there, Nehru sent his army because he wanted to grab Kashmir, because Kashmir is a very, very important state. It's considered to be the crown jewel because of its beauty, of its natural resources, and so on. And the Indian rulers, right from day one, were, of course, completely dishonest even about accepting Pakistan's existence. So they thought that if they grab Kashmir from Pakistan, or thought the wishes of the people of Kashmir, then perhaps they could undo the creation of Pakistan. So that's why they sent the Indian army was sent in there through a very devious method, and gradually they tightened their grip on Kashmir, and that is the situation that we find today up to this
day. And the British walked away and let it become a festering problem.
Absolutely.
Now the UN has followed them without, by the way, giving it the sanction of saying it was okay. They just simply did it.
Yes.
Yeah.
And although, we need to, I need to emphasize this point, that the plebiscite formula still remains on the United Nations books. It is renewed every year. What is required is, the procedure is that any member of the security, the United Nations, can simply write to the Secretary General of the United Nations to keep that particular item on the agenda. So the Pakistani delegate at the United Nations does that every year. So the issue of the plebiscite remains active on the UN Security Council agenda.
On the agenda.
Absolutely.
It is unfinished business.
Unfinished business. It has not been, yet India very stubbornly refuses to abide by it. And the irony of it is that India also is striving to become a permanent member of the very Security Council whose resolution it repudiates.
Yes. That's It's a cruel irony. Zafar Bengash, it's a pleasure talking to you. We appreciate all the information, and we look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thank you for the opportunity, Phil. Take care.
Thing. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Taylor Report, CIT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, and we're going to take a little break, and we will hope to come back second half, talk to Jean Saint-Ville about Haiti.